Welcome to Next Gen Mentoring Forum. This is Next Gen Mentoring Forum. The series is designed to empower, educate, and illuminate individuals who are interested or already in the financial planning industry. As each forum, an expert will discuss the topic in the field of financial planning with purpose of inspiring critical thoughts and discussion. In today's session, I'm very honored to interview Ashley Murphy, who is a CFP, AIF, and CEPA, on the topic of what is international financial planning.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me on here, Chi-Li.
Right. My name is Dr. Jolly Jen. I am an assistant professor and director of financial planning program at California Lutheran University. I maintain an active financial planning practice specializing in succession program management at Value Growth Institute. I've authored three award-winning books. Most recent peer-reviewed research book is published by Palgrave Macmillan and entitled Enhancing Retirement Success Rates in United States. Next Gen Mentoring Forum is sponsored by California Lutheran University School of Management Financial Planning Program. We offer MBA in financial planning that helps financial advisor pursue a leadership position and grow their financial practice by deploying advanced financial planning techniques, effective client communication, financial counseling, streamlined practice management, as well as how to leverage fintech. Today, we are very, very fortunate to have Ashley Murphy with us. He is a tri-citizen of US, Australia, and UK. He's also the founder and principal of, I'm going to try this one, Arete, right? Wealth Strategy Australia, fee-only financial planning firm in the investment management from the Australia and American expatriates in US as well as Australia. He's also principal and founder of the Global Financial Planning Institute. From 2014 to 2017, Ashley taught the CFP programs at the UC Berkeley Extension and Golden Gate University. We have a lot of things in common there. I haven't taught in those two places, but I know a lot of people taught there. Okay. He also served as a Knowledge Circle host for the Financial Planning Association International and Cross-Border Knowledge Circle from 2017 to 2019, and is a regular conference speaker. He holds a graduate diploma in financial planning in Australia, making him one of the few financial advisors qualified in multiple countries. Ashley has been quoted in Wall Street Journal and profiled in Financial Advisor magazine. He lives with his wife and two daughters in Minneapolis, Minnesota. He enjoys cycling, reading, world travel, and is the futurist with interests in architecture, renewable energy, and demographic. My goodness, welcome, Ashley. It's really, really such an honor to have you here. To put things into perspective for our audience here, tell us a little bit about where you come across international planning. Is such a niche business. So share with us your kind of your path to today.
Yeah, I thank you. It's a pleasure to be here also. So really, I was born into it. You know, I wish I had a better answer for you as to some incredible story, but I was born in the UK, raised in Australia, and moved to the US about 15 years ago. And when I moved to the US, it was just in my head that there must be some forum out there, maybe a website, some sort of organization. If not that, then at least a book that introduced folks to international and cross-border financial planning. But what I found was, upon entering the business, there actually was nothing. And I spent 10 years looking under every rock, attending every conference, and inquiring everywhere I could to find out where I could learn more about international and cross-border planning. And it just wasn't to be found anywhere. But originally, I got started with the vision of doing what I'm doing now, but it was quite fortuitous, you know, as is often the case when people are telling their stories, right? there was a financial advisor I had an informational interview with, And then about 2 years later, she had a client, a prospective client. And she said, well, gosh, this guy's Australian. You're Australian. You must know everything there is to know about financial planning in Australia and cross-border and all this stuff. So I'm just going to refer him to you. And I was sweating bullets. I was like, oh my goodness, I better really study up. So that's when I enrolled in that graduate diploma. And I got really busy for a couple of years doing that study as well. And now it's funny that you asked that question, Dr. Chen, because only 2 weeks ago, we finally made the move. I don't think the website has been switched off yet, but we had a domestic facing brand and an international cross-border brand. And the domestic brand is about to be turned off. So we only do work with Australians in America and Americans in Australia.
Wow, that's fascinating in terms of when I look at your website, I was looking at not just from the planning itself, the business model that you have in place is incredibly robust. And this is something that I often tell my students that, or even any clients, that you really, really need to look far ahead to structure your business model well enough. And you actually hit that spot. So congratulations for the success of this area. Now, the questions that I have is that when you talk about Australia and US, obviously the law is different, the tax is different, and lots of different things are different. So how do you actually help clients, especially if you're talking about just two different countries? I know that most of my clients are not expatriates, but they are certainly wealthy and they have properties all over the world. Yeah. And they probably hold more than two citizenships. So how do you step us through in terms of what clients are typically looking for and what kind of things that they, it's beyond their belief, if you will, that needed, especially for the planning side?
Yeah. I think the best way to answer that question would be to determine what stage that client is in the expat journey. So are they preparing to move? Have they just moved and are getting acclimated? Have they been here for a little while, but they don't really know if they're going to stay? Maybe they're waiting for that promotion or to meet Mr. or Mrs. Wright. You know, I call those folks the domicile uncertain. They don't know if they're coming or going. And then there are the permanent movers. There are the folks that have moved over here. Maybe their kids have, you know, gotten into grade school or high school, or they've just gotten a fantastic job opportunity and they said, we're going to stick it out. The needs differ depending on the stage. But as you would know, Dr. Chen, really, there has to be some kind of precipitating event that brings someone to your office, or more right. Accurately these days right. in COVID, brings them to your Zoom room instead. There has to be something happening. So money in motion, something's going on. For me, I find that is typically someone departing the US, you know, an Aussie is departing the US and they say, what happens to my 401k? How do I get my money out? How do I not get fleeced by foreign exchange? That would be one set of concerns. Another would be Americans in Australia that have investment accounts here and are concerned as to their proper management because they get into all sorts of issues with that. So that's two examples of the kinds of issues that bring clients to me in the first place.
Do you then strictly work with expatriates? Do you work with other people? Like in my example, where I have a client who is a US citizen, well, actually, he doesn't want to declare US citizen because he is a Singapore citizen. Uh-huh. They don't recognize dual citizenship. Oh. And he has tons and tons of real estate in Singapore. So he just kind of maintaining that. He also is a citizen of a Taiwan. So he's actually have juggling all these. So would you be working with someone like that who is not a expatriate, but have properties and citizenships around the different world?
I mean, in theory, not that character profile, not, you know, with those particular citizenships as you were implying there. Certainly with the globally mobile Australians, The thing that comes into it, though, is compliance. So all of us eventually, you know, will have to be registered, you know, to work in the U.S. And you'd need to figure out what the regulatory stance would be in any of those foreign countries. So Australia, this is a different topic, and I won't go into this in too much detail, but Australia has gone from being a laggard to a leader in terms of compliance. It used to be the case that it was the Wild West, you know, back when I was graduating university, anything went, you know, it was a really, let's just say you would not consider it a professional service. You know, the folks that worked in that field maybe last week were selling shoes or cars or something, and now this week they've decided they're going to try and sell insurance or mutual funds or whatever. But that's all changed. You know, there were a couple major inquiries, and the regulatory landscape there has been turned on its head. And it's now, I'm proud to say, I'm not too proud, don't get me wrong, because it's far from perfect, but I'm proud to say it's really the first country in the world where they've made financial planning a true profession, meaning you cannot call yourself a financial planner if you haven't done a degree in financial planning, mm-hmm. if you haven't passed an ethics test, if you have the hurdles are very high, the barriers to entry are very high.
And I heard from a few Australian advisors, if you will, they told me that years ago, like what you said, that they could pretty much do a lot of things. But today, not only the degree, the certification that they need to have, but is it also true that it's slowly moving into fee-based and fee-only kind of structure in Australia compared to US?
There's nothing slow about it. It was, I had a presentation at the FPA conference last year, and the slide that I depicted to show what happened was, it was shown tongue in cheek, but it was a 1950s atomic bomb detonation, you know, a nuclear test, because that's what's happened. There were 2,400. Now, keep in mind, the Australian financial planning business is only 20,000 advisors to begin with. There were 2,400 departures and 15 entrants into the field in 2019. That's what it did. So it went fee only. They've restructured commissions on insurance. So it's a very difficult environment, you know. And that's the thing, is while I commend them for making this step in the direction of fiduciary and professionalizing the field of financial planning, they've gone too far. You know, the politicians have assumed every financial planner is a crook and is a Bernie Madoff. And so they've had to come up. Yeah, it's completely ridiculous. And we're now seeing the regulatory pendulum swing back in the other direction, because no one can get advice anymore. To do something as simple as, this is a good example of how bad it's become down there. Very often, I know this is a next gen group, and you know, we're all just getting into the business here, but a very, very common and easy situation, I think you'll agree, Dr. Chen, would be a client who may be have a 401k plan that does not look very good. The investments in there are all very expensive, actively managed funds. And you can, as a professional with some experience, you could look at that a mile away and say, these are very average funds at best, very average funds. And it would be an easy recommendation to say, let's move that over into a lower cost alternative. You know, we're not going to, you know, recommend necessarily Vanguard or DFA or whatever, although they would commonly be recommended. But if you are moving from a high cost structure to a open platform, low cost structure, it's almost inconceivable to imagine what the disadvantage would be in doing that.
And does that mean that from your perspective, servicing your clients, these are all the various details, not only from a compliance perspective, but also from fee structure and how to approach clients, are all very different in terms of different countries' regulations and compliance?
Yeah. So, exactly. And continuing with that previous example, to make as simple a recommendation as that would require that a planner undertake a statement of advice, which would cost a couple $1,000s, and they'd have to do a detailed fact finding, look at before and after cash flows, And that's all very rigorous, and that part is, you know, maybe you could make the case that that's good. Honestly, I would say it's unnecessary. You know, clients come to you, especially, you know, a fee-only credentialed advisor, and they've got a lot of trust. They're saying, I trust what you're saying. The need to do a full financial plan to justify moving from a low-cost product from a high-cost product to a low-cost product is unnecessary. And so that can be a barrier to people engaging with advice in the first place, is those high fees. But as for the business model that my own firm employs, thank you for your compliment at the outset there, Dr. Chin. It's taken a long time to arrive at it. And I can no longer say that I'm the only firm that has exactly the model that I have, because coincidentally, my friend and she's a presenter in the GFP Institute, Marina Hernandez, who actually was just interviewed by Michael Kitsis, his Financial Advisor Success podcast, interviewed her, that came out just Monday this week, actually. She has the same business model. And so with clients in all these different countries and, you know, all the different complexities, we've really had to tweak, you know, how we work with them to make it profitable.
I think she is also in today's attendance. So hopefully that we'll get her to say a few words at the end.
Really? The end. Is she?
Yeah, I think she is. So my question to you is that you gave us two examples of someone who was working in US, departing, potentially has a 401k, need to get out, or someone who is an American working in Australia that needs some sort of activities in the management in the US. Can you give us an idea of what clients are typically looking for, other than the 401k and things like that? Give us a picture of what are they typically facing in terms of what kind of triggers and what kind of planning that you typically do for these type of clients.
So I'll take the first part of that. I think what is appealing about the business that I have, or that you yourself would have, or Marina would have, is that clients are seeking to reduce the number of contact points. You know, people are busy and it's difficult to find time, especially if it's a couple, you know, to coordinate their schedules and meet with someone. And so if they can meet with an individual that understands both environments, and a third knowledge set that's not taught or mentioned anywhere, and it's not obvious either. And that is, there's obviously the US financial knowledge that one would need to have. There's the knowledge of that foreign country that you need to have. But then there's a knowledge of how the two work together, because that particular pairwise, that bilateral combination is going to be unique. Is there a tax treaty? How does that tax treaty work? Is there a totalization agreement? Is there an estate tax treaty? What are the relative advantages? You know, if you're speaking with a client, and going to the second part of your question, if a client has certain things in one country, are those financial products superior in a foreign country, or are they better in the US? Would they be better advised to buy them here or there? Are they portable? Do they travel well? A very common example there would be with Roth IRAs. If you had a purely domestic client, it's pretty common. You know, people would say, once you've, you know, if you're in a given situation, you would do well to think about funding or converting funds into a Roth IRA. Well, for someone who's globally mobile, who might be moving to a country where that foreign country doesn't recognize a Roth IRA and treats it as some kind of foreign trust, where the growth in that account is taxable, well, you just committed financial harakiri, in that you've now taken a tax deductible account, or a post-tax account that has otherwise tax-free attributes to it, and you've made it taxable. So you get double taxed on it. So that would be an example of what not to do.
Can I ask a question before you move on? Is you mentioned about tax treaty.
Yes.
To your knowledge, and I have heard a few of them, but I'm not totally understanding these kind of portability or tax treaty kind of policy. To your knowledge, how many of those countries that do have some sort of tax treaty with US, and then what type of accounts, such as Roth that you mentioned, actually does make a big difference in terms of these type of tax treaties?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I'm learning more and more about it all the time. I'm first going to excuse myself for not knowing even more about it. But and the reason for that is I haven't needed to, you know, I focus on one country and therefore I just need to know that tax treaty. However, in teaching the GFP masterclass on international planning, I've come to learn from the tax attorneys we've had as guest presenters that there's really been a couple different templates, if you will, of the tax treaties. And so there was the original templates, and then there was an updated template in the early 2000s. Each country's tax treaty does vary, though. So there's some generalizations you could make about how retirement account portability works, but maybe the Canadian or the UK treaty might recognize Roths. I know, I think it's a UK one that does, whereas none of the other ones do. And also it's important to keep in mind when a particular treaty came into being and what subsequent legislation took effect following that point in time. So in the case of the Australian tax treaty, that was signed in 1983 when Ronald Reagan was the president. And that coincidentally was a couple of years before the superannuation system came into existence. Superannuation is the name of the Australian retirement system. So how do you have a comprehensive tax treaty that predates the existence of the very retirement system that the whole country uses? That brings up tremendous uncertainty. And so a never-ending topic. In fact, there's a webinar I'll be attending tomorrow on this very topic. A never-ending topic of discussion is how does the IRS tax these foreign retirement accounts? Because it's not clear. They're certainly not in the Internal Revenue Code. They're not in tax.
Depends on how you interpret that.
And even just looking at Australia, you can literally shop your opinion. There are tax attorneys out there that would say, no, this a superannuation account is in fact can be deemed a public pension, and therefore it's exempt. It's tax free. And then you get the most conservative tax attorneys that say, oh, no, you've got to pay this tax and that tax and this other tax as well.
So does that mean that for someone who would like to do this type of work, would you suggest them to have a good handful of attorneys, tax attorneys that need to kind of bounce off ideas with? Because this is all depending upon the interpretation in terms of that incident.
And that makes it very, very, so the short answer is, and the long answer actually, is yes, absolutely. You need to have trusted service providers. The thing is, you have to also weigh in a little bit yourself. And that's difficult if you're not an expert. I'm not a tax attorney. But the way I've come to take the views that I have is surely these tax treaties weren't written in a way where these expats can get away with paying no tax and be in a position even better than citizens of either country. That just doesn't make sense. That would have been the spirit and intention of that law. So, you know, what are the more reasonable interpretations? How do we pay some tax to one of the governments involved in the situation?
If I may interject a little bit, I like the fact that you say you have to weigh in based on your knowledge as well as some reasonable interpretation. For example, just a couple of weeks ago, I have a client who typically works in Vietnam, China, and Japan, and Taiwan, and is also a US citizen and is also two other citizenships, in the other words. Wow. And then they all of a sudden transfer a large amount of sum of dollars into the US, and they were in the panic mode to call me. And I'm like, why are you calling me? You already made the transfer. It's a little bit too late. But what she was explaining to me was, you know, in the US, I am just a single mom housewife. And I said, wait, but you are married. And she said, well, but in that country, I was married, but in US, I'm just kind of like, wait, that's not reasonable. You are married, you're married globally. You can be handpicking. In the US, you are considered single. So do you run into a situation like that in terms of how does advisors actually weigh in on a reasonable type of interpretation.
Yeah, I do all the time. And it's, you know, the blessing of this particular niche is that it is totally underserved, and the barriers to entry are very high. As a result of that, there are a lot of prospective clients. And if someone is just not advisable, you know, if they're doing something that's not within the letter of the law and they seem as though they're not going to comply, then I just don't work with them. I say, you know, right. Sorry.
Well, because the complexity is so different in two different countries, and you do have to live up to the both